I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 126 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. We've had a few legendary master and engineers on Caro Pop, and this week's guest is legendary with a capital L, Greg Calbee of Sterling Sound in New Jersey. If you love music, you have loved recordings that Greg Calbee has mastered. Ever hear the Bruce Springsteen album, Born to Run? Calbee mastered that and has some thoughts on how it turned out. He has stories about working with David Bowie on Young Americans, John Lennon on Walls and Bridges and more, and Harry Nilsson on the Lennon-produced Pussycats. Who is a joy to work with, and who started doing lines of coke in the studio? Calbee mastered about 20 Bob Dylan albums. Did those two interact? Calbee mastered classic Ramones albums. He mastered the original pressing of Television's Marquee Moon, mentioned in a few recent Caro Pop episodes. Calbee's albums just from 1979 include Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' Damn the Torpedoes, Talking Heads' Fear of Music, Supertramp's Breakfast in America, David Bowie's Lodger, and The Jam's Setting Suns. He also mastered REM's Murmur, Paul Simon's Graceland, and The Strokes' Is This It? Plus, he saw Todd Rundgren doing idiosyncratic Todd Rundgren things. Which 2006 album does he consider to be one of the best-sounding releases he has mastered? He received a Grammy Award for his work on the 2018 album of the year, Kacey Musgraves' Golden Hour. He mastered The Smiles' latest, Wall of Eyes, and the new MGMT album, Loss of Life. Calbee tells us how he got into live engineering and mastering, and the big break that involved recording, yes, performing close to the edge. How did he transition from working on LPs to CDs and back to vinyl? What's his philosophy when it comes to mastering albums? He's known for giving digital recordings the warmth of analog. How does he do that? Are there telltale characteristics of albums he masters? Could he tell the difference between an album mastered by him or former Caro Pop guests Bernie Grundman, Kevin Gray, Chris Bellman, or Ryan Smith at Sterling Sound in Nashville? Do audiophiles place too much emphasis on keeping every step of the process analog? Would he rather work with a digital copy than an iffy original analog tape? What stars must align for a great-sounding master? Does he consider his original masters to be definitive, or have some reissues raise the bar? Is 180-gram vinyl more of an upgrade or a marketing ploy? Does he think vinyl albums are too expensive? And when did he get chills upon realizing he was one of the first people to hear a classic album? Please enjoy this very informative, lively conversation with a master of mastering, Greg Calbee. You're a music person, not a sound person.
I am, and that's why people always say, "What do you have at home?" And I go, "Like, I don't at home. I just listen for music. I don't listen for sound. I don't drive myself crazy. I just don't. I mean, I spend all my time in this room trying to avoid listening to the what I like or what I don't like. It's irrelevant whether I like your album or don't like your album. It's what's relevant is I try to get the most energy out of it and try to, you know, it's just a different way of listening, completely different way of listening. And I don't want to do it at home. I don't want to second guess myself. I never had a listening room that was tuned in such a way that it's really going to sound great. And so I have a bunch of Sonos speakers lying across this. I have like a big room. It's about 50 feet by, I'd say 25 or 30 feet. And it's the kitchen, the living room, the dining room. You know what I mean? Like, it's just big open space. So it's just ambient sound in there. And then I have a little room that have my, you know, a pretty good turntable and a pair of BMW speakers. And they're not tuned or anything. I was listening to Procol Harum, Salty Dog album this morning, which is one of my super all-time favorites. I pulled it out. I hadn't listened to it in forever. And so I'm much more music-oriented than sound-oriented. But if something sounds like shit, then not that happy. Have to, you know, kind of.
So do you listen to most of your music at home on the turntable, or do you sort of stream stuff through your Sonos around the house?
It's kind of has morphed a little bit. I mean, I would say most of the time I listen on the Sonos and I listen to playlists. And then, you know, like, for example, there was a playlist and a Boy Genius track came on and I was like, wow, that's a pretty good band. And then for a week or so, I'd be listening to the Boy Genius album. But a lot of the songs I didn't like, some of the songs I did like, so I kind of got off them. So I kind of stream in there. We were on like a KD Lang radio thing on Spotify. And it was a great assemblage of playlists. That was a great playlist, you know. So I kind of use the playlist to learn about new artists. I recently found Laura Marling that way. Laura Marling has had an album that she did with Ethan Johns a couple of years ago, which is fantastic. Super spare arrangements. Beautiful voice, really well-crafted song, and I had never heard of her before the playlist. So I'm kind of using that room as that, and then my other room I have a Macintosh DDA converter, like a Bluetooth, which is great, and I'm on Qobuz lately. Qobuz sounds fantastic. It sounds better than Spotify. I think I think it's the best sounding one. Way better than Spotify.
Better than Tidal.
I think it's better than Tidal. I had a problem with my Tidal subscription. I kept paying for the free and I kept getting commercials and I couldn't get any help. I tried for a couple of weeks to go on and try to get, you know, I was paying for a service that I wasn't getting, and it would drive me crazy to get commercials. So I got rid of Tidal, and Qobuz sounds better actually, but it sounds really great. So I listen on my regular stereo with the BMW speakers and the Pass Labs amp and everything. It's not audiophile, but it's good enough. It's pretty good. So That's kind of the way I listen. If something's important, and I don't have a big album collection. I have maybe 1,000 or 1,500 albums, whatever. And you know, I just get onto one, and just like in the old days when you're too freaking lazy to change the record, and you just listen to the same one that's on a turntable. Just keep listening to it until you're tired of it, and then put another one on.
If you got sent every album that you mastered, you'd have a much bigger collection, I would imagine.
Yeah, I know. It's somewhere about between 8,000 and 9,000. We estimated one time it was about 8,500. That's the number that I've been throwing at it.
That's the latest number.
Well, we used to do an album a day. You know, we did an album a day, and now we don't do an album a day. Now we do 2 songs, 3 songs, 9 songs, EP. You know, you still do albums, but I don't do the same, and I'm not working as much as I used to. But you know, I did some math, and you know, I have been doing this for 51 years now. So it's you know, it really is possible that I've listened to more music than maybe almost anybody, because it's been a continuous, you know, 40 to 50 hours a week for so many, many years, you know. And in the CD era, I was able to keep a lot of the CDs, which I don't listen to, but they're like souvenirs to me now. I get to remember the sessions, the artists, you know, people that wouldn't show up on an old playlist, or you know, just somebody that, oh yeah, this was a pretty good record. You know, this was whatever happened to her. She never got anywhere. And she had a couple of good tunes, you know, that kind of thing. It makes me feel good to kind of file through them, you know.
Would you buy an album on CD now, or is that just done as a format for you?
No, I wouldn't. I would stream anything on Qobuz before getting a CD. No.
Discogs has your first credit for you as listed as William Bell's Phases of Reality. Wikipedia, the first one they list is Yoko Ono's Feeling the Space.
Is either
of those correct?
Well, Yoko, I did a couple of records for. Yeah, I did one with her, Milk and Honey, which was after John died. After they did the Double Fantasy, and then right. The second one was the kind of the leftover stuff from that. Her stuff, and that was a pretty memorable session with her. But she came in with me a bunch of times.
But was your first one, though? Was Feeling the Space the first album you mastered on your own?
No, there was one that I did. I think there was one that I did at the Cutting Room when she was at the record plant Cutting Room, when John was around all the time, and I did a couple of albums with John and a couple of John albums, and then the Harry Nilsson album that he did. And I think there was a Yoko album during that time, but I don't remember exactly which one it was. I'm sorry. I just don't, you know.
When you started off, were you thinking mastering? Or like, how did you sort of get, because I imagine the first thing you did was probably live engineering and then kind of got into the more specialized mastering. Like, how did that all happen?
Well, it wasn't live engineering. It was just kind of grunt work. I had finished up a master's degree up at the University of Massachusetts. And I really wanted to be a journalist, and I was really interested in like a music journalist or documentarian. And then I got, you know, I've always been interested in radio, and you know, there wasn't that many features done on radio. It was like not pre-NPR era or whatever, but I kind of wanted to get into either news reporting or doing documentaries on sound wise. I don't know. I didn't exactly know what I wanted, but when I taught, I was like, well, at that point, I was 22 years old. And I taught a class, it was called The Rhetoric of the Modern Media. And I brought a lot of music into it, and analyzing lyrics and talking about the cultural implications of rock music. And, you know, this is like the early 70s. So the 60s were pretty fresh. And you know, I mean, the generation that I'm in, maybe the generation before you, it was really important to me. But I, you know, I found that that wasn't true necessarily for a lot of the kids from the hinterlands of Massachusetts. Not everybody was as sophisticated, hate to use the word, but there were a couple of kids in each of the classes I taught who really resonated with it. And, you know, we used to just used to print the lyrics out and talk about them. And it was really good. And also did stuff about television. I did a master's thesis. My thesis was television, exceeding use of television watching affected political it's cynicism and political participation. And I said, wow. the more kids watch TV, the less they're going to get involved. So
little did you know what was coming a few decades later. I mean, that's, you can write that now.
Little did I know. It was ridiculous. Anyway, so when I came to New York, I was selling shoes again, like I did in college. And I got a call from a friend of mine who was working on a recording truck at Record Plant. And I ran into this guy, and he said, occasionally they need people. And I was like, call me anytime, and I get a job. I mean, I can take off anytime from the shoe store. And I started driving a remote truck. The first gig was, yes, close to the edge, Duke University. So I drive to North Carolina with this truck with a friend of mine, you know, smoking pot, driving this big truck. And I had the experience driving a truck. But so when I started the remote part, I knew nothing about recording. I didn't know where the wires were going to the microphone. I mean, I was not really a musician, but I had no electronics background, zero. So that got me into the studio. And then once I met the guys in the studio, then I got into the studio to be like the general helper. The job was called the general. But I still didn't know anything about recording. I still didn't know anything about electronics. And I started picking up on the fly. And then there was a cutting room there that the guy who got me the job was working in. And I used to help him with the cutting. So I gravitated towards the cutting room because there were a whole lot of assistants, and my friend really needed help doing what he was doing. It's a long story. I don't want to bore you with, but
no, it's interesting. That's why I asked.
I kind of followed the energy that was going on in the studio. And, you know, I worked with Todd Rundgren one time, and he asked me to do something. He asked me to patch something in. And I said, I don't know how to do that. I don't know, only know how to work the machine. It was crazy that I was thrown into that thing, but that's the way that Record Plant was. It was such an interesting thing that so many fantastic engineers came out of that environment. Everybody was taught in such a non-linear way. You just had to pick it up by watching and by asking questions. Don't ask too many questions, but try to pretend like you know this and that, and ask another assistant who might have asked a question last year, and he'll show you. And it was trying to navigate my way through that. But I liked, because I had been a student and spent a lot of time reading and studying, I liked the kind of the quietness of the cutting room. I liked the, it was more of an internal thing. You know, if you were down in the studios, you know, you'd be going, getting coffee all the time, running out into the studio, setting up microphones, the endless amounts of wasting time, overdubs, endless vocal overdubs, guitar overdubs. It was just boring to me. It was freaking boring being an assistant, not being the engineer, not knowing what the engineer was actually doing. So my feeling was upstairs was kind of better for me. And then when people would ask me my opinion about things, it meant something when I had the lathe next to me, because I was going to be transferring their mixes onto what people were going to hear. So they, you know, gave me like some responsibility in that part of the process. The mixer would come up, he'd listen to it with me. Well, what do you think of the bass? I'd go, I don't know. It sounds like it's a little heavy. Oh, really? Uh-oh. Okay. Well, what can you do to fix that? And then you go downstairs and he, you know, he remix and send another mix up. So I learned about the dynamics of the thought process of what a mixer expects after he finishes mixing and during, but basically after. So the responsibility of it, I like that at that point.
Right.
And apparently they like me because I ended up getting on some major, major records in, you know, 1974, 1975. It was incredible. You know, Young Americans, David Bowie, three John Lennon albums, Eric Carmen, All By Myself, Platinum album, Three Dog Night. I mean,
do you remember what your reaction was to Yes is Close to the Edge in that first experience? Like, were you a Yes fan? Was there any sort of like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm like listening to Yes record a new album?
Oh, I listened to Fragile endlessly in the 2 years before that that I had worked with him. I couldn't believe I was like on stage behind the curtain, and Rick Wakeman was like, if I reached my arm out, I could have touched him. I was like, and I'm looking at the audience, I'm going like, I had never been on stage. I was in, you know, my high school auditorium. I was in the performance of Oklahoma. I had never been on a stage before, let alone a giant band like that. And, you know, the whole aura around the traveling with those guys, they were like gods, you know, walking through a hotel lobby, Chris Squire with big leathers on and, you know, handsome, tall, handsome guy, you know. Yeah, the whole thing was a magical experience. And then there were a bunch of other ones. The Beach Boys came kind of right after that, maybe 6 months after, with the Carnegie Hall for the Beach Boys. And, you know, I was a huge Beach Boy fan, and I worked on that thing. And so I kind of got, you know, I was dunked in the water in the right, exact, perfect depth for somebody like me who really didn't know anything, but get that kind of out of the way, you know, that part of the show business thing. Nixon's inauguration was another one that we did, 1973. Went down to Washington and recorded the music after Nixon's inauguration.
that's a rocking album, Nixon's inauguration.
Yeah, there you go. Right?
I'm waiting for the 50th anniversary remaster of that one with the deluxe bonus tracks.
I wonder who was in. You know, I should look on. I'm sure it'll be on, you know, somewhere. Like who actually was on that show? I don't remember the show.
All right, we're gonna have to look that up.
Yeah, another good remote was Allman Brothers and the Grateful Dead the following summer at RFK Stadium in Washington.
Nice.
Yeah, and Allman's opened, and then there was a long intermission. The Dead came on. I think my memory was like 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and about midnight, I was fried. I was like, nope.
Did you have to get over any kind of starstruck, you know, ness when you're told, hey, you know, John Lennon's coming in or David Bowie's coming in?
Totally. I mean, there was some freaking. I mean, John was could disarm that. By John was very easy to work with that way. Yeah. You know, Bowie was, he came in with a couple of models, probably two of the most beautiful women I had maybe ever seen, but until that point in my life, never seen anything like it, two of them. And he had his white makeup, he had like white makeup on and with the fedora hat, he was doing that period, you know, like the city fedora thing, you know. I was scared shitless, and they took out some cocaine and started blowing some coke. And after, I remember it was like maybe three songs in, because he wanted to listen to the whole album with them, right? So, and by the third song, they got, you know, they were all fucking tooted up and everything. So they just said, okay, thank you very much. And they just walked out. And that was the end of that. But I was really nervous for Bowie. I was really nervous. Harry Nilsson didn't give me a chance to be nervous, because he just came in the room, listened to like 30 seconds and looked at me. He said, I hate these fucking places. And he turned around and walked out.
was that on Pussycats? That's the one that John Lennon
produced. Yeah, Pussycats. Yeah. Yeah. They were tortured on that one.
That was kind of like notorious A, because it was part of the whole Lennon Lost Weekend where they were kind of on their, you know, getting out all the time. And then also he sort of tore his vocal cords apart on that. So
it's a great album. I mean, he was just sensational. But, you know, the thing was, I was working the lathe, and the lathe was going to make the acetates and the lacquers for their products. So you had to be treated with a certain amount of respect. You didn't want to like shit on me at that point. And me not do a good job. You know, everybody was motivated for me to do a good job. So I really caught, as opposed to the abuse the assistants would get downstairs, I didn't get the abuse. I got more of the support.
Was John Lennon like sort of a detail guy? Like, was he like, oh, I like the EQ on this? Or
not when he came to mastering. He did in the mix, he would do endless mixes. See, the thing is that he mixed in Studio C, which was around the corner from the cutting room. So when they would mix something, the assistant would bring the mix in to me, and I would cut an acetate for him to John to listen to at home. He always listened from a cut record. So I would get to hear like Too Many Rivers to Cross. I heard maybe six or seven different mixes before the final one. You know what I mean? So he would really grind through the process. What people do now on Pro Tools, you know, with everything being recallable, very simple. But in those years, he had to come in another day and do the mix another day, and then we had to transfer it to a acetate, and then he would take it home, blah, blah, blah. So he definitely spent a lot of time trying to get the mix right. But once it got to me, then it was basically like, you know, send it over there, and if it sounded okay to him. But I do remember that I did not like the fact that his voice was mixed back too far. I would always want to have the vocal louder. And one time when he was in the room, I said, you know, we should make the vocal louder. He said, oh, this is rubbish and terrible. I did the terrible singer, terrible job. And I turned to him and I said to him, I said, John, you're like one of the greatest singers in the history of rock and roll. How could you not like your voice? He says, that's rubbish. Don't push the voice out. Don't do that. I said, okay, it's up to you. But, you know, I had to tell him. But, you know, I had a relationship with him that which was, you knew what you could say to him. And what, well, he was just like a guy, man, when he came into that. He was very like a worker bee. You know, I always call those guys worker bees. He wasn't a star when he was around that studio, but he was there. He was always there because he hung out with May Pang there all the time. So he would go from the Dakota and just come to the studio, and he'd be in one of the lounges, or he'd be in the owner of the studio had an office that they would hang out in. And May was always around. She was friendly with everybody. So, you know, they would come in together once in a while. I mean, she'd sit on his lap and they'd be bouncing around. She was extremely attractive. Yeah, it was good. But, you know, I think that was really good for me to have that experience of being relaxed with people, because I would get nervous through the years with different artists coming in. There's no doubt. And some would make you nervous by being nervous themselves about what the product was, what the mix sounded like, you know? So,
And it sounds like John Lennon was open to hearing your opinion about stuff, that he was not just like, oh, who you think you're talking to me? You know, it's like,
no, John was a lot of fun. I've told the story many times. If you've heard it, I could stop. But there was one time where in the old days, a tape would usually be on a reel, but sometime it would be on what you call a hub. So the tape itself was visible and it was open. And if the tape itself was not wound properly, if you dropped that tape, or if you didn't put pressure on the right way, it would fall into the ground and just be like a pile of tape, like all skewed all over the place. So I had a box that I had dropped this one old jazz tape, and I had to fix it. And the only way to do it was doing it by hand, right? So when he came into the room, he looked at the box. He said, what's that? I said, and I told him the story. He said, is there any way you could make that look like it's my tape? And I said, well, sure. I said, just put it on the machine and I'll splice in the crappy part, and it'll look like it flew off the machine. He said, perfect. Perfect. So he called the owner of the studio and he starts screaming at the owner. This fucking kid doesn't know anything. Bullshit. He doesn't know anything. He's terrible. You got to fire him, whatever. And the boss came up. Roy Sicali came up. His face was white as a ghost. And he came over to the machine and his hand was shaking a little bit. And all of a sudden, either me or John started to look like, and then we both started laughing hysterically. And Roy just looked at me and said, I'm going to get even with you. He never did. But that was all John's idea, you know, do a little practical joke. So, you know, it was great to know him that way, you know, but I have to say that as much as I did work with him, when I saw him in the street a couple of years later, walking around the West Side with Yoko, I wouldn't go up to him and disturb his privacy. I didn't feel like we had that kind of relationship. I didn't feel like we had anything to talk about other than, you know, how are you or whatever. I just wanted to respect their privacy. And my ex-wife got really mad one time. I can't believe we're not going to go say hello. I said, I'm not doing it. Not doing it. So, you know what I mean? There was a line between the work thing and
your relationship was in the studio.
Exactly. You know, and I'm 26 years. I'm 26 years old. And John is like 10 years older, 9 years older. So we're young people. I mean, it's not like, you know, he's not like this is when you tell these stories, sometimes you forget how young we all were, right? even at that point. So, you know, it's just the way it's rolled out. But, you know, a lot of the people that I met have been surprisingly different than you would think. And most of the time, I don't remember anybody that I was like cowering in front of, you know, people could make you nervous. It was a job where you really did not want to fail, you know?
Did most artists come in at that point, you know, to sort
of... most of the time, the artists who really were, you know, the artists who had out the significant albums would come by. Bruce didn't come in. Bruce came by one time to listen briefly. He didn't get involved in the mastering at all. Jimmy Iovine, that gun, you know, came in.
For Born to Run.
Born to Run, yeah, but... You know who was really James Taylor was great. He was involved. He came in. K.D. Lang was great. I mean, you never know when they come in whether they're going to really be interested or they just want to kind of see it to the end, you know. But they really used to come in a lot, and I miss it so much now. I get folks coming in now maybe three or four times a month. I used to have maybe three or four a week in the studio, you know, just sitting and having coffee and chatting about their process and their, you know, their experience. And, you know, I mean, for Emmylou Harris to come in, and I was the biggest fan for like 30 years. And all of a sudden I'm sitting there talking to Emmylou Harris, smoking, she's smoking cigarettes and telling me about, you know, when she was lived in Washington, D.C., you know, it's like, what, I'm getting paid for this? Are you kidding me? This is fantastic.
I assume there must have been artists who would come in and kind of nitpick and drive you crazy a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, the nitpickers were, yeah, they were, yeah. It all depended on their, see, it's so, I keep having to re-remember how it was, because you couldn't really go back and remix a lot of times. You could once in a while, but mastering had to make up for deficiencies in the mix that the artist would know about when they came in, and they would try to get you to do things, and sometimes didn't understand the limitations of working in two-track rather than a multi-track. So, you know, you could make the voice sound a little bit better, but you couldn't make the voice sound that much better. You could do it to a certain extent. In those years, a lot of people would have shitty stereos at home, and then they would listen and think there was a defect when there actually was no defect, because it was actually a defect in their listening environment.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, you know, one of the wackiest, you know, some of these stories I always figured I could tell better when I was retired, but like the craziest one, not nitpicky, but so strange, was Todd Rundgren. Cause Todd would come in and he would kind of like push me out of the way from the equalizer, and he'd start twist and turn. And he would, you know, he'd listen to a song for no more than into the first chorus, maybe for like a minute and a half. And he would twist and turn, severe EQ, like big, big change. And then he would just do this thing with his hand, you know, next song. And he'd go through the whole album in like maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes, not even 15, 20 minutes, doing this every time. And I had to sit and scribble down all the settings and everything like that. And then, just make him the new version and send it to him. And then he would come in like 6 months later, and I would ask him, you know, how'd that sound? He said, I didn't listen to it. I was doing something else. I knew it would sound good. So he was the opposite of nitpicky.
He is someone who I think of as being sort of a total studio rat, right? And someone who's
someone who
wants to be in control of his environment all the time, whether he's working on his stuff or bands he's producing. I mean, I've had like three guys from XTC on who I'll talk about him doing Skylarking, which is a fantastic record, by the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you had Wizard to True Star, where it's like a half hour on each side, and it's so dense, that mix. And you're just like, well, this must be what he wanted, because it's just so like, you know, like claustrophobic sounding.
I could never tell at that stage. You know, I did a couple of Utopia records, and there was another one, Pursuit of Happiness, a band out of Canada. Pursuit
I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that Pursuit of Happiness might have been one of the ones where he did this. But yeah, it amazed me, because he was so technical and he got such a great sound, but then he would come in and he would massively change it, but he didn't seem to really attach himself to it. He seemed like he moved. I really couldn't figure out his process at all. I just couldn't. And I remember one thing he said to me, which I thought was really remarkable. It wasn't about mastering. I was talking about pre-production. He says, I don't do pre-production. He says, that's the band's job, is to get the album ready. I record the record. I don't do pre-production. And all producers, what that is, used to do pre-production. And they kind of go in, work on the songs, work on the arrangements, work, you know, it's like, nope, that's not my job.
Yeah, but then, you know, again, on Skylarking, I mean, he took their demos and sequenced the entire album before they came in and did string arrangements and all that. So he might be protesting a bit much, because it seems like he had a lot of control over what the album was going to be, other than just the band coming in and playing the songs they wanted.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got the new Smile record, which you engineered. I mean, which you mastered, I think. Does Johnny Greenwood or Tom York get involved in the mastering? Are they coming in, or are they talking to you?
They do anything that they do through this guy, Tim, who's their engineer, the young guy. He came in here. He really liked what I was doing, but everything goes through him, and then he goes to them. And so I had no conversations with either of those guys. A lot of artists work that way. They're much more comfortable in the mix area, and with the mastering, they want the engineer to kind of go in between. Some artists, you know, I mean, I've done like maybe 20 Bob Dylan projects and never spoke to him, never had any communication directly with him at all. He's done everything through his manager. He has like a music manager person. He also has a business manager person, but everything goes through Jeff Rosen. And then Jeff talks to Bob, Bob talks to Jeff, Jeff talks to me, and we go round, round and round.
Well, and you did Blood on the Tracks.
Well, I didn't do it in, you know, when it came out in 1975, 76, I didn't do the original mastering. I did a reissue of that. And it was,
oh, okay.
It was, yeah. I think it came out great, but that was probably in the early 2000s. I think I did that one. And, you know, that was a reissue. The reissues are interesting because, you know, you really don't want to take it into into where it wasn't, but you also want it to be a better sonically than it was. And you have to really walk a thin line. And my friend Steve Berkowitz is the person who deals with Bob's production stuff. He's a like an executive producer, and he kind of is the musical person dealing with in the actual studio itself. Jeff Rosen doesn't come into the studio. Steve kind of, and his thing is, okay, what's the document that we're trying to improve on? And he always uses the album, the actual vinyl album. And we'll put the needle down on the vinyl album, and then we'll put the mixes on whatever we have, whatever copy we have of the mixes, which is another whole technical, I don't know what you want. It's kind of a freaking mess, man, because you never know what you're going to get with the old tapes, because some of them just lose their, they just lose their vibrancy. It's hard to just, a magnetic tape is not always the best thing to use. So, and then there's all the different versions that they can scrounge up from all over the world, you know, cassette copies from Germany or something, you know, that's a whole thing that I think even a lot of the audio critics don't really understand about the mastering, is that the source itself has got to be the best source possible. And sometimes that best source is just not available. And then they will blame a mastering on, you know, if they're unhappy with the mastering compared to the original, they kind of don't know where to turn as far as, well, why wasn't this mastered better? Well, it wasn't mastered better because there was nothing physically available that sounded like what you remember hearing, which is why I always say, if you see a record, a vintage record from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, until like 1990, and it's a record that you like, freaking buy it, man, because it's never going to sound as good. Probably never going to sound as good. The reissue probably won't sound better. And I've worked on a bunch of reissues, and sometimes I couldn't make it sound. I thought Talk Is Cheap. The original Talk Is Cheap was from an analog tape, and I think it sounded better. That tape just didn't, I did everything I could to make that tape that I was given, and it was the master tape, but it just didn't have it anymore, you know?
Yeah, I feel like there's this thing where everyone wants AAA from the original master tape, but you don't know what kind of shape the original master tape is in. And,
exactly.
You know, I mean, is it better to have, you know, a really high, you know, definition digital copy of something than a master tape that's kind of gotten old and lost some of its luster?
If that digital copy was made on a good converter at the right time when the tape was cared for properly, you know, tapes don't like temperature variation. If it's stored in heat for a long time and then it was put in cold, you know, all the magnetism things, weird things happen to tapes all the time. So those original vinyls are, they're pretty good. I mean, I listened to not every Beatle issue, but there was one particularly where my original just had a certain life to it that the new one didn't have. I mean, it just didn't have it. I mean, it's not everything can be explained when you come to stuff like this. Not everything has a so maybe somebody wants to give an explanation, but sometimes it's just pretty mysterious, you know, but you have to really know the whole process. Well, a lot of times the tapes, you're just not, they just don't have them anymore. You know, they just don't have them. They can't find them. They're gone. People were very careless with tapes. And there's also a lot of stuff floating around that assistants made copies and brought them home, and they're sitting in people's houses. And, you know, as the years go on, maybe some total gems will be revealed, because assistants used to do that. They used to, you know, make a copy for themselves when everybody was gone, put it aside. I mean, I kept nothing. I mean, I kept the acetates that I could have kept, I probably could have retired at this point for sure by selling some of them off. That's some really, but I would always just throw them, you know, put them for recycling. I didn't keep, I didn't keep any of that stuff. If I had some of those XTC mixes from the original one that I worked on, and you know, something I didn't send out, or something that had a little problem, one skip in it or something, and I just put it in the trash. You know, it's like recycling, rather than that trash they used to recycle on.
Do you think there's too much emphasis on keeping everything analog in the process, or do you think that that's, you know, still the optimal combination?
Well, it's only optimal if everybody who all the equipment is in optimal condition. Just by being analog doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be better. I mean, people do, they'll come in here once in a while and want me to make a tape, an analog tape of their digital copy, thinking that the analog is going to be some kind of a magical thing, like to give it a certain texture or feel. And sometimes it does, but sometimes it does. It's all, no, the AAA analog with great engineering, with the tape machines that are biased properly, with a tape stock that is excellent. The tape stock has to be good. The tape heads have to be in good shape. The electronics of the machine has to be in good shape. Everything has to be in good shape, and then it has to be passed through into, if it's vinyl, it's got to be, everything in that chain has to be good. The console has to be good. The cutter head has to be excellent. You know, it's really a tremendous achievement to have a AAA album sound great. And it's just not for the faint-hearted. You have to have a tremendous skill set all the way down the chain, you know. And we, you know, Sterling always had great cutting lays, because the owner of Sterling was a tech, and he maintained those lays. Sterling stuff always had this magical high end to it. It's just he did something with the cutter amps where he just knew how to tune them, and you get a certain kind of high end that other people didn't have on their cutter racks. You know, did nothing I did. It was just because I was at Sterling, and the tech there was great. The techs are the unsung heroes of all this stuff. You don't even hear about them. You know, you read about, I'm sure if you interviewed, you know, any of the classic great old engineers, I'm sure Al Schmidt would say the same thing. He probably had his fantastic, you know, you can't have a great studio without everything being working optimally, you know.
Are most of the albums, like the newer ones that you master, are they almost all coming in from digital sources at this point?
Yeah, very rarely mixed just to analog. You know, the only time we get analog mixes of these days are from like young kids who have like a romanticized version of a vision of what analog is. And it's usually, the music usually fits, you know, it's usually can be like almost like a classic rock kind of thing, you know. And sometimes it's great. I mean, sometimes it's really, really good, and it does have that feeling. But I'm going to say 95% of what we get now are all digital, you know, and what we send out is digital too.
One of the things I read about you is that you're known for his ability to give digital recordings the warmth of analog. Like, what's the key to that?
Well, it's because I pass everything through a converter that makes it analog when I process it, right? So if something comes in digital, almost 100% of the time, it comes out of digital into an analog converter, which makes an analog signal. And I have two different ones that have different textures. Then I go into a whole bunch of analog equipment, and I have analog equalizing. And then I have a converter back to digital, which the ones I have, to me, are the most analog sounding, although they're actually digital. So I try to establish the warmth and the depth of analog. And then the fine tuning is kind of like those, if you look at those tools as like, if somebody was a cabinet maker, and it's like his, you know, the little files and the little drill, this is like the much more fine tuning, the super fine tuning. But the global sound I get through my analog console and the electronics of the conversion. And there are people who are mastering engineers who do phenomenal work without ever using any analog. There are mixers who do phenomenal analog sounding stuff, all in the box, what we call in the box, which is no analog equipment whatsoever. But, you know, to me, it works really good, because it gives me like a chance to kind of sculpt it in one way, and then give me a chance to kind of go in and do some more relationship of the instruments and try to get certain things to kind of spread out and appear. Yeah, there's a visual element that I get. So it's like textural and then visual and fine tuning, two different types of tools. But if you have less work to do with the fine tools when the analog tools give you something satisfying. And it actually all depends on how good the mixes are to begin with. You know, if mixes are really bad, I can make them sound better. Well, you know, but I can't make them sound great. I can't make a great sounding record from bad sounding mixes. I just, right. Not going to happen.
I always found the concept of soundstage to be fascinating, like that you could have two different masters of an album, and one of them you'll feel like the instruments are kind of surrounding you in the room, and the other one everything kind of feels like two-dimensional. And yeah. And I'm sure there, you know, there are very technical ways that you do that, but as a listener it just seems like, wow, it's like it's magic. So like what, how important is soundstage, and how do you get that to, you know, become, you know, the way you want it to sound?
Well, you can do a certain amount of that, but basically what that is making the right choices so you don't diminish with the mix. Most of the time, if you're comparing two things, one of them has been sacrificed by either the electronics used or the mastering tools. They're the ones that the source itself had. In other words, it's not like you expanded from the source. It's like you preserved the source as opposed to diminishing it. So if you heard two different vinyl albums, for example, and one of them seemed to be more spacious than the other, probably the one that's more spacious was the one that sounded more like what it was like in the studio, and the equipment that was used to transfer it was just, the electronics were really, really tuned up and fantastic and had that sound to them, whereas the other one didn't have the tools, didn't have the equipment, so it kind of took away from the sound of the tape. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
But the reverse is true, especially with the digital plugins. There are all kinds of plugins and expanders and all kinds of stuff, and you can do a lot of that. But it's much more. You know, I think that what I do probably differently than a lot of guys, and I hear this from people, is that I kind of don't need to put my imprint on something. It's like if I hear something that I like, my job is to preserve that, not to diminish it. And that's the most hurtful thing to me, is when somebody says that, you know, well, we like what you did, but the original mix had something, you know, it had more this or it had more that. It's like, wow, I'm not here to take anything away. I'm here to enhance, you know. So I really take that. I take that personally, and I kind of dig in and try to figure out, well, what was I thinking that made me kind of do that? And it was probably, you know, it was probably me thinking that a certain musical elements were more important to me than they were to the people that created it. And it's all about what their vision is. So if I can expand their vision, then I've done the job.
Yeah, that hooks into what I was about to ask you, and maybe you just answered it. I was going to say, when you started, what was your philosophy about mastering, and has that changed over the years?
So you got a historical perspective between 1972 when I started, 73 and 1993, everything was about the album, the LP, right? The LP started to diminish in importance compared to the CD, not right in the beginning of the 80s, but sometime I'd say between 85 and 88, where the CD would have been the thing that you would really concentrate on, right? So the job in the beginning was really like, okay, what is this going to sound like on vinyl, and what do I need to change? For instance, a lot of the bass sound, if you now listen to a reissue of something on CD that was reissued and mastered well, and listen to the original album, generally you'll hear the bass won't be as deep sounding and as bottomy as the modern one, because in those years we had to monoize the bass. Stereo bass does not cut well. On a cutter head will jump up and down. That's where you get skips and everything. So you had to take the tape, and you had to actually sacrifice some of the elements of the tape. If you had the right kind of equipment, you could do that in a much more transparent way. It's not like taking a sledgehammer to it, right? So just having the ability to have a cutting lathe in those years that would preserve the mix was like a big thing, right? And and then the increments that we used to use, for example, I don't want to get too technical, but you know, the equalizers themselves would be like 2 dB or 0, 2, 0. Now we do like a tenth of a dB in or out, tenth of a dB, 2/10 of a dB. The equalizers in those years had like, sometimes would have 2 dB increments. You wouldn't be able to do half of that, even 1 dB. So you had a very coarse way of dealing. Like if John Lennon did, if I wanted more vocal on a John Lennon album, I had 2 dB at 1.4. If I was doing it right now, I'd be able to massage that and do all kinds of different frequencies and a tenth here and a tenth there, whatever. So there was much less of an opportunity to do these big sonic enhancements. But the main thing was to get that thing to cut loud and clear. And that was kind of like an architecture of the vinyl itself, because the longer the side was, if you had a 22 minute side, your grooves could not move as deep. They couldn't go as dig into the vinyl. And the quiet records, the short records, the 16 minute sides, you know, the Supertramp 16 minute side or anything 16, 17 minutes, that needle would dig down in and you get more energy. I mean, the needle would be moving more quickly. It wasn't just volume. It was like a certain mass that would be created by the physical movement of the cutter. And this is completely different than when we get to the digital era. This is irrelevant at that point. Right. So there's a whole other thing where you become more of a fine tuner and a corrector as opposed to a preserver. But the big, I mean, when Todd did that, I don't know which album. I don't think it was 30 minutes. I think it was like 28 minutes. It was really long. That was the only way to do that was to make it super, super quiet. And you know, it was cut. I don't have a copy of that one, but I'd be curious to see it in the studio and just see how quiet it really was. But, you know, that we would have competitions with other mastering places and, you know, it would just be like, he made a louder one. One of the things you would do to make a record loud was to add a lot of mid range and take a lot of the bass away. And that's unfortunate. And then, you know, then you have the whole cassette era, which was another thing where people would listen to their mixes on cassettes. And that was a shit show because everybody's cassette machine sounded differently. They'd have the Dolby in, the Dolby out, the speed change.
If you have like a master by you and one by Bob Ludwig and one by Bernie Grundman and one by Kevin Gray and one by, you know, Ryan Smith down at Sterling in Nashville or Chris Bellman, like, are there tells for each mastering engineer? Like, could you just tell, like, without knowing which one is you and which one is the other guys? Or
in this era I probably couldn't, but my all-time hero in mastering was Doug Sachs,
right?
In Mastering Lab. And Doug's stuff to me always had, you always knew that that was a sound. And the thing is, Doug and his brother used to design the equipment that he used. They didn't sell it. It was the stuff that they had at Sheffield Labs. And his stuff really had a sound, okay, a specific sound. Steve Markeson had a very bright percussive sound, and I could always tell when something was a Markeson thing. It was really exciting, a really great engineer, and he was his stuff was like kind of like on the bright side. Doug's stuff was always much more warm and very analog and very, very natural. It's a much more natural sound. And even now when I get if I see an album, even one that I never heard of and his name is on, I'll buy it for 10, 15, 20 bucks, whatever. I just love what he did. You know, Bob Ludwig, the different eras had different sound, always great. He's just a really great engineer. And the thing with Bob that I always respected was the great artists would go to Bob and they would go to him for years and years and years. Right. And so he knew how to really keep an artist happy and loyal. And he's, you know, I just have so much respect for him. He recently retired. So he's kind of out of the picture now, but his stuff, it wouldn't be like I'd listen to it and go like, okay, let me predict who mastered that. And then look at the credits. It would be more like I'd look at the credits and go, oh yeah, right. That sounds like Bob. Or right. That sounds like Stephen Monk. Kevin Gray is a great engineer. I don't really know his sonic signature at this point. My friend, George Marino, one of the great engineers, George always had extremely crystal clear mid range, which I always love that sound. Always plenty of vocal, plenty of detail in the mids. Not an aggressive sound, but not a harsh sound. So he, you know, the guys do have a sound, but it's not one that I could kind of pick out and say, oh yeah. And then there's all the English guys in that era who were great too, which I don't really know one from the other, but there were, you know, three or four great English engineers back in the 60s, 70s too, that did beautiful work.
What would people say are the characteristics of one of yours?
I have no idea. No idea. It's hard. You know, it's hard because when you do so many different genres and, you know, I mean, I just did a record. A friend of mine actually was talking about this. He read an article about a band. He says, oh man, these new bands, man, they're unbelievable. I read this amazing sounding record and I read about it in the New York Times. Mannequin Pussy was the name of the band. And I went like, I think I mastered Mannequin Pussy. So I came back to work and I looked at my computer. Sure. I mastered it. I listened to it. It's complete punk, forward, aggressive. It sounded fantastic. But, you know, I also do the national, which is ambient and, you know, wide open and not that. So I get such a variety that I really don't know what anybody would say about what I do at this point. I really don't get it. I've had so many great jazz albums that I've done. You know, lately, budgets for jazz have shrunk to nothing. We don't get that much jazz stuff, but I've done a lot of really great jazz albums. In the 90s, I did some beautiful work with Craig Street, with the K.D. Lang and Chris Whitley, Cassandra Wilson. These were beautiful, beautiful recordings. You know, you have to have the raw material to work with to get stuff that sounds like that. So, you know, I just try not. I think. That if anybody would say anything about me, I don't overcompress and I don't do the blisteringly loud compressed sound. I don't do that. I'll do it if I have to, if the client needs it, and a lot of the people like it. And my job is to make them happy with what they're doing. It's not to criticize what they're doing. If somebody asks my opinion, I'll tell them, and we will back off a little bit. But you know, this is another long conversation about what volume should you make your digital masters be at for optimal listening. And it's so complicated to talk about. It's just mind-boggling. It actually is mind-boggling. If I was to describe it to you in a different juncture, a more technical conversation, I could tell you exactly why. I mean, if you have any questions about it, I'm happy to address it here.
Certainly on CD, like in the early 2000s, there was a time where like every CD was just so loud that it was like, at first you're like, oh, this is rocking. And then by like the third song, you're like, oh, this is kind of hurting my ears.
My ears. Yeah. Well, that was kind of the beginning. See, the tools to make this stuff loud weren't really developed in you're talking about like the mid to late 90s kind of thing.
Yeah. Or like really, I mean, like I remember like it's a loud record anyway, but like Green Day's American Idiot. I just It just was like, it was, I think that's one of the ones that was kind of pulled out and sort of like the loudness wars.
My partner did. Yeah. Well, there is a lot of reasons for that. A lot of it have to do with musicians and their level of level that they need to feel excited when they're listening in whatever equipment they have. Musicians notoriously have the worst audio equipment. Very rarely will find a musician with an audiophile system. Very rarely.
Interesting. And
sometimes they have nothing at all to listen to. But the thing was, in the early CDs, probably if you buy a CD that was manufactured sometime between 1981 and 1990, they're really quiet compared to the CDs in
Absolutely.
The 90s.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, there was no software at that point to be able to make them louder. As a matter of fact, if you sent something out that was too loud, it would get rejected. At Sterling, we had a guy who actually figured out a way to make the Sony machine that everybody used to transfer for the manufacturing copies. There was a trigger light that would go on when something was over the limit. And he figured out a way while we were making our tapes that he disabled the trigger light. So we started making the loudest ones in that era. They were actually... They were loud, but they were never rejected. So, and I don't know when everybody figured out that we were doing something like that. But the loud thing was really important. But the loud then and the loud now is completely different. The loud now is, you know, the other thing is that things that are recorded with samples, a lot of the hip hop, everything that there are really such, there's way less dynamics on that stuff. So stuff, you can really make it sound loud, but it really has no push to it. You know, it's really complicated. And then what everybody listens to, Spotify, for example, has a setting, a maximizer setting where you can disable. Nobody does that. Nobody disables that. So they basically hear everything that's already been brought down in level so that they would all be the same level. But there is a button on your Spotify if you go in a little bit and it says take the maximization off, and you can take it off and then everything gets louder, like much louder. But your playlist then vary, you know, so you'll be listening to what can I tell you? Listen to a Jason Isbell track and then a Johnny Cash track, and the Johnny Cash track would be lower because of the source of that would have been lower.
Right.
And then there's Sirius XM, which I think levels everything. It's just, I don't want anybody to think this is an organized thing, what's going on in our business technically. It's completely crazy random. And then you got, immersive audio and Atmos, and you got this other whole.
Right.
So
So do you have to master an album, you know, at least sort of twice, you know, one for the sort of streaming and then one for the vinyl pressing, and then maybe you have to deal with the Atmos and all that too?
Well, the Atmos is a mixing process. So that happens before it gets to us, and we can't, our engineers, we have two engineers that can master Atmos, but Atmos a lot of times is not mastered at all because it's already in a certain format where you can enhance it, moderately enhance it. I mean, we heard a Billy Joel thing recently that was mastered down in Nashville at our studio down there, and it was mastered, but very fine tuning of the image. But vinyl, okay, so this is why I was asking you before about whether you buy the new vinyl or the old vinyl, right?
And I do both.
Yeah, well, right. But the new vinyl, if you take a loud CD level and try to transfer that to vinyl, to get to vinyl, you have to become analog. You have to put that through a converter. And if it's really super loud, the converter it's not clean at that point. The converter gets kind of diminishes the quality of what that CD. So you're immediately going to vinyl with something which it sounds worse than the CD sounds. And then you have the whole vinyl chain. So any of these super loud records that are done these days, when they move to vinyl, we do another mastering for vinyl, where we reduce the compression to a point where it doesn't take the thing and make it sound different. It just preserves the dynamics that people are used to listening to. So we do a vinyl, what we call a vinyl mastering. If I do a jazz album and I already have plenty of dynamics and I don't push the level on them, we can just take that and we advise the client, no, you can use that to cut the vinyl. That's fine. And my partner Steve Fallone and I, we'll evaluate what we do, and I'll get a call. Sometimes I'll call him up and say, well, this is kind of borderline. What do you think? And he'll give his opinion, and I'll say, okay, let's make another version. And it's a fairly easy process, and take maybe a half an hour to kind of take the digital files that we have and put them through a different maximizer setting that we use for the digital level. And we kind of roll that back a little bit, and then you get a little bit more movement. And then by the time you get to the vinyl, which is going to sound different anyway, And I think we get a much better sound that way. But I've been so disappointed with vinyl that I bought a Richard Thompson album a couple of years ago. It's like, oh my God, this is freaking, I didn't want to master it. It's awful. And the digital, the streaming, I A-beat it at home. This, because I love Richard Thompson. Anyway, this Richard Thompson album, it was horrible sounding. And I
Which
was
one
so,
is it?
It's not the recent one. It's like two albums ago. But anyway, so I put Spotify on my speakers, and I listened to the thing, and it's like Spotify stream sounded like a million times better. I said, what happened here? So I have no idea who cut it, but it was a bad experience. But you know, every once in a while, some of the new stuff sounds great if it's done nicely. My son loves vinyl. He drives me crazy. The first question I ask him, I say, how much did you pay for that? He goes, oh, it's only $30. I go, you paid $30 for that? I said, just get the stream. What are you doing? Oh, I like vinyl. You know, it's all okay. Whatever.
It's funny. It's funny for a mastering engineer to be arguing with the son about not getting vinyl.
Well, it's $30, but you know, I'm from the era $299, $399, you know, that's how much they were. If you actually paid for them, because a lot of times we didn't pay for them. We just got them.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's new premium lager, Cold Time, is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's packaged brewery fresh and never pasteurized. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans that, I must say, have a really cool-looking blue-on-blue design. You know, hear that like an album that you feel like you really nailed mastering is getting remastered. Does that ever irritate you? Like I did that. I did the definitive one of that. Why are you remastering that?
Usually you see, this is going to reveal a weakness of my own. I get so mad that I didn't get to remaster it that I won't listen to it. That's just so funny. You know what I mean? Like what? That sounded great. What'd they do? So I don't get like an academic thing and try to figure out if this is better or this is worse or whatever. So I have to say that I haven't had that experience, but if anything pops in my head next few minutes, I'll try to remember it. But yeah, well, you know, one of the things that it's kind of almost, it really is like a sore spot with me, because when I mastered Born to Run, I had 2 years experience. I had a Scully tape machine, right? And we cut the vinyl. Basically, it was at a very early part of my career, from the mixes that were, you know, it sounded like the tape sounded off that tape machine. And, you know, Bob Ludwig, who's been he did so many projects for Bruce over the last 30 years. He always does a great job. And, you know, to compare what I did to what he did with the great equipment that he's had over the years. And, you know, he had so many more resources along with his talent. And that was the one thing, because I just love that album so much. And when it came out, it was such a thrill for me to listen to it before anybody heard it. And it's just one of those things where I wish that mine represented a little bit more of what, you know, what my ears could actually do. But that being said, just having my name on that record for all these years has been a great, you know, it's been just been a great thing for me. So, but when I put it on and put the needle on, I go like, ugh, I wish it sounded better. And I'm sure the reissue sounded 1,000 times better.
Yeah. I was wondering if there, you know, if there are certain experiences where you know, you get the tapes to master and you're like, oh my God, I'm like one of the first people hearing this classic album. Like, I know this is like an all time great album and nobody knows it yet, but you know, me and a few other people.
Well, that was the Born to Run experience, because they were working in the studio. My wife, who I'm married to now, she was a receptionist then, but she was friends with the whole band. I get the mixes. Jimmy Iovine would send the mixes over. But when I first heard Jungle Land, I'll never forget the this feeling that I'm sure you've got times in your life when you get chills like on the back of your neck and you kind of just, you know, it just overwhelms you. And I remember when that sax solo came in Jungle Land, it was like, it just blew me. I mean, it's like, oh my God. And 10th Avenue Freeze Out, because we were right near 10th Avenue at that point. We teamed between 8th and 9th. So both of those songs, they represented so much. And I was such a huge Bruce fan even before he came into the studio. And that's when the music was just so important, you know, it was so central to my whole experience. Right. And that's why when I can't even listen to the Dawn. I have a copy from the original press. I really can't listen to it. It's just, you know, what can I tell you? Did the best I could with what I had at my disposal at that time at 24 years old.
Well, it did just fine when it came out, you know. People appreciated it. People loved that record quite a bit and loved how it sounded. So I think you did all right.
Well, that's what people a lot of times, well, you know, they tell me something, "Oh, you worked on this. I love that record." And I always say, I said, "You would have loved that record no matter who mastered it." And they go, "What? You're being humble." I said, "No, I'm being realistic. You would have loved that record no matter who mastered it, but the artist would have loved it better if it was mastered better, or the producer would have loved it better. But if you love an album, you're going to love the album." I love Peter Gabriel's So. It was one of my favorite albums of all time. The first mastering of that was terrible. Thin, scratchy, sibilant. It got reissued and sounded much better in later years, but it was not mastered well in the beginning. And it was one of my favorite albums of all time. But still, I love that album. Oh my God.
Yeah, I probably have that original one, because I would have bought that one right when it came out.
Graceland was one of those ones where the reissue was really great. And I've had this discussion with my friend Steve Berkowitz about this, because I remember when I mastered, I did very, very little to that. And, but this is one of those things where I think the tape had more energy than in the reissue. And the reissue sounds great, but when I listen to both of them, I prefer the one from 1986, not because of anything I did, but I think because the tape had a little bit more life to it. But that's just, you know, very, very close. And Ryan Smith did a fantastic job on that. But that was one of those ones where I had, when I got the copy that he did, I said, okay, now I got to see what the old one sounded like, you know? And like I mentioned early in the conversation, there's a lot of things that you can control and some of the things that you can't control.
I'd seen an interview with you where there was someone sitting down with you in the studio, and to sort of show off what you thought that was the best sounding thing, you put on John Mayer's Continuum.
Oh, that's funny.
And then I joined that Vinyl Me Please group, and right when I joined, they had a version of that I think your colleague Ryan Smith made.
Yeah.
is like, was he able to improve upon what you did originally, or like, how did that one work?
I would love to hear it. I know he didn't do that from the source, because the part of those mixes were on 1-inch 2-track, which is a very rare format. We had to rent this. There was a machine that we would rent, an ATR machine that would have, you know, 1-inch 2-track is like unheard of. Half inch is the usual at this point. Quarter inch was the original, then it moved to half inch in the 80s. But 1-inch was around that time that they did that album, and I think I'm now you got me definitely some homework, because
all right,
the CD of that to me is like unbelievably great, and I'm using it because we've been testing out some equipment, and the song Gravity is just the perfect, to me, the perfect mix, perfect sound, beautiful low end bass drum, everything is like sets up. I love it. I use that song every time I go to listen to somebody's house with their new system. I put that song on, and like that will tell me what the, how the system sounds.
Right. And you'll put it on as a CD.
As a CD. Yeah. As a CD. Yeah.
All right. So, yeah. And to go back to Marquee Moon, you did Television's album from 1977.
Yeah.
Rhino had a Chris Bellman cut a few years ago. Now they have this Rhino High Fidelity, Kevin Gray cut. Have you listened to the various versions of it?
You know, this is a strange thing, because not only haven't I listened to it, but I have no memory of mastering it, zero memory of mastering it. I think that in those years, there was so much great stuff coming through Sterling, you know, like the Jam. I used to do a bunch of stuff for the Jam. I did the first two Blondie albums, did a bunch of the Ramones albums, and the marketing, you know, that one came in Television. I don't remember it, but I've gotten people that know that I mastered it, and I the Richard Lloyd album, the solo album that he did, I remember that one.
Alchemy.
And a friend of mine, I actually engineered that, and it was probably the most boomy mix I had ever heard. It was so off, it was so wrong, it was way, way off. I would love to speak to him about that. But the guy, Bob Clifford, who did that, been a friend of mine. He's been out of the business for a long time. I don't mind going on record saying with this one. But this is a funny thing. Like, a lot of stuff comes through, which at the time has no importance. But over the years, I mean, that's really held up for a whole generation of musicians, that album. It's huge, you know?
Yeah. But there's something so crisp about Marquee Moon that you feel like it could have been recorded yesterday.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I know I don't have any copies of that. I don't have any.
So haven't done the ABC comparison of all the different mastering engineers on that one.
None of that. Yeah. You know, I don't know what it is, but I try, everything I do is in the studio, you know, to do any kind of critical listening. And like I said, at home, I don't, but, you know, it's always pretty busy here, and, you know, I'm working a little bit less now. I work 4 days a week. So I usually don't have that much time, but you're piquing my interest in a lot of this stuff, man. You give me a little too much homework.
I don't know. You've done so many favorite albums of mine that are totally different from one another. I mean, like, I was very into Supertramp before I kind of started discovered, you know, like Talking Heads, and you've done both of them. You know, you're doing Even in the Quietest Moments and the Ramones the same year, and you're doing 79, you know, you did Breakfast in America, Lodger by Bowie, Setting Suns by The Jam, Damn the Torpedoes, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Fear of Music by Talking Heads. And those are all really different sounding records, and that all hold up in these different ways too. So
you're making me nostalgic for when I used to work on a lot of things that I really liked. Yeah, that was that's a pretty good stretch right there. And then Damn the Torpedoes, it's coincidentally, you know, Shelly Yackas, who mixed that, who top engineer of all time in the U.S., you know, top three, top five, just an amazing mixer. Tomorrow he's sending me a record for the first time in many, many years. I'm going to be working with him. Well, he's not coming in, but he's sending me some stuff to work on tomorrow. But the Damn the Torpedoes, when I put the vinyl on that one, man, the drum sound, that is an amazing vinyl. And I don't have many gold records at home. I only have like four or five, but Damn the Torpedoes, Graceland, Born to Run, you know, the ones that really meant something to me, you know, and some of the other ones have hit the old trash pile. You know, anybody want a Meatloaf, Meatloaf second album?
Is it
Bad Hill too? I'm happy to donate it for.
Was that
know.
Dead Ringers? You got, is that, was that the name of it? You got a Meatloaf gold record or just a record?
It's a Meatloaf. It's a giant. It's one of these big giant gold records. You know, I actually gave the Continuum gold record to one of my wife's friends had an exercise studio, and she had a lot of wall space. and gave it to her as a gift because I'm not going to put up a big giant gold record in my apartment. I don't have any room for that. I want to put art up. I don't want to put a big giant gold record. And that was it was a pleasure to get it. But, you know, there's a very famous engineer whose name I won't mention. And then he rents his house out as an Airbnb. And somebody told me he walked down the hall and he's got like all his gold records all over the whole hallway and in the bedrooms and everything. It's like, come on.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you could find a home for like the giant Meatloaf gold record. I feel like there would.
You want it? I'll send it to you, no charge.
My wife would be like, "What?"
Yeah, what? I know.
But no, that would be great. Do you have any sort of bucket list or anything where you think, "Oh, I would love to remaster this album"?
Well, I would. Yeah, I'm only it's fresh in the mind of the conversation. I'd love to get the tapes on Born to Run and see what and see if those tapes sound as good as I remember them sounding in that era and transform. That would be one, only because I'm disappointed with what exists with my name on it. But that's not going to happen. That would be one of them.
Any thoughts about like colored vinyl, 180 grams? Does any of that make a difference to you?
180 gram is kind of understood to be more of a marketing thing than an actual benefit. But you know, the old skinny vinyls that we used to get back in when they used to, those were pretty bad, you know.
Dynaflex. Yeah,
the 180, listen, the 180, if you have an audiophile market and people have a turntable that's decoupled from the stand and, you know, the whole thing about the vibration and, you know, the tone arm and everything. Yeah, in that sense, the 180 would probably give you like a little bit of an advantage to some of the low end sound. For somebody to spend a lot of money that they don't have on 180 gram to put a sticker on, maybe not the best use of the funds at that point for a lot of people. Not 100% sure. But you don't get a chance to really A/B that. You know, well, let's press up like 1,000, and then another 1,000 at 180, and let's put it out there and see what it doesn't happen that way. So you'll never really know. You never get a really good test of that. Color vinyl is noisier. It's kind of well known that it's noisier. But, you know, somebody told me just last week that something like around 80% of the vinyl records sold, people don't even open them and they just have them. Don't even listen to them. Have you ever heard that?
No. I'm from the forums that I go on, it sort of doesn't surprise me because it seems like people view so much of the stuff as collectibles as opposed to things you're going to listen to and enjoy. And I understand the impulse, you know, you buy something and then you go on Discogs and you're like, oh, look, it's the median sale price is more than I paid for it. But
yeah,
I don't know. I still think it's music. I'd rather listen to it than look at it.
Yeah, well, me too. But that's the thing with the color vinyl. I mean, it's a fun thing to open it up and it's like, you know, turquoise or red or something like that. I mean, there's audiophile vinyl. There's audiophiles who listen to vinyl, and then there's regular listeners, and then there's just people that, you know, go to a show and just want a souvenir. I mean, I don't know how many Taylor Swift albums were sold. I know. Maybe hundreds of thousands at this point, but I would imagine that a good 80% of those haven't been listened to also. Nothing wrong with that. Vinyl has been a great thing for Sterling, and I think it's been great to focus on artists, and also I think all the stuff that you meant, even what you mentioned before about putting an album side on, listen to five songs in a row without the impulse to kind of jump up and get bored and switch over to another song or another artist song, you know?
Right. Are you a fan of 45 RPM? You know, splitting it, make it single album, double album, 45 RPM?
Oh, those always sound great. But I get irritated when I just hear three songs and I got to go turn the record over. But the 45 for certain things, they really sound great. And my 45, 12 inch 45 of Back in the Chain Gang is one of my, that's one of the best records that I have sound wise. Mm. For original pressing from, I guess that's early 80s or late 70s, right?
Yeah, like 83, I think the single was. The album was 84, but I think it was out a year early. A year, or it might have even been 82, but I know that it had been around by the time it showed up on Learning to Crawl.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I remember that. When we used to do the 12-inchers and they would order 45, we'd get really excited because you could really put the, and remember the thing I was talking about before, about the energy generated from a cutter head and then from a cartridge kind of moving like that. It just has a different set, like flowers, you know, it's great. It's really great stuff.
I should really go back because I have a lot of 12-inch singles from back in that era, like Talking Heads and all that sort of thing. And I Tom Tom Club, I haven't put those on in a while.
Yeah.
They probably would, you know, make me bounce around the living room.
I mastered that, the Tom Tom Club, the big hit, the first Tom Tom Club song. I mastered that. I was in that whole, you know, that whole era, and I was in the right location to work with David and Chris, and you know, that New York scene. People were channeling stuff to me, and I was really, you know, it was a great period, and it kind of lasted pretty much until my daughter was born, like 1986, and then I kind of stopped going to the club, stopped going out, you know, was home a lot more, and then the scene kind of changed a little bit, and once it got into the grunge era, I wasn't like a go-to guy with the grunge stuff, and that the Nirvana, you know, I didn't work on Nirvana, I didn't work on really not that much, you know, a lot of the producers that came through, and then there was some of the original kind of like white hip hop that kind of started to kind of, you know, like dance music, you know, morphing into, you know, that was not part of my whole thing. So, but that era that you talked about, for me, that was the most fun. You know, I really had a lot of fun. The people that came in were great. Do you remember what your first record was that you bought, or what did you like, you know, going back?
That's so funny, because I've been asking guests this, and I didn't ask you, but the first record I think I bought on my own was the Jackson 5's Greatest Hits.
Uh-huh.
And I also, the first singles I think I ever got were Michael Jackson, Rockin' Robin, and Jackson 5, Little Bitty Pretty One. Because when I look back at my singles, those I think are the oldest ones that I'd actually bought at the time. What was your first record you bought?
And I actually have it in my music room. It unfortunately has a crack in it, but it's a Bill Haley and the Comets, Skinny Minnie.
Mm.
That was probably 1958, I think, 57 or 58, 9 years old. I remember where I bought it, Larry's Record Shop in Bayside, Queens. And if you listen to this song, Skinny Minnie, it's such a great rhythm record. It's not like what you would think like an 8 or 9 year old would like. And it was, I just love the rhythm of that record. Skinny Minnie, Bill Haley in the Comets. Check it out.
It sounds pretty hip for a 8 to 9 year
old. It was, man.
I'm gonna definitely check that. So I got some, we both have homework now. So that's good. All right.
Hey, it's great talking to you. And
thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Take care of yourself.
That's it for episode 126 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Greg Calbi for taking us into the studio so we could hear how the magic happens. Calbi and Steve Fallone now work together on projects at Sterling Sound in Edgewater, New Jersey. You can find more information about their work and how to book them at sterling-sound.com. Sterling Sound also is on Instagram at Sterling Sound, one word. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who was born to run tape. Digital tape, just give me some leeway here. Now you can become a Carol Pop friend for a mere $24. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. And you could follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.